87. At the Fount of Science. The dispute with Sir Logdin was still weighing on Reuben's mind the next morning. Arguments left half-developed kept occurring to him. But the day that followed was a lucky one, and he was able to put their inconclusive squabble behind him. He was in the quiet little top-secret den on the third floor. It had heavy curtains at door and window, a shabby sofa, and a threadbare rug. The soft furnishings muffled sound, but there was hardly any noise anyway. Reuben was wearing earphones, listening to his tapes, and Smolosidov, looking haggard and scowling at Reuben as if he were an enemy rather than a workmate, said not a word all day. As far as Reuben was concerned, Smolosidov could have been an automaton, there simply to substitute one reel for another. Donning his earphones, Reuben listened over and over again to the fateful call to the embassy, and then to the taped conversations of the five suspects supplied to him. Sometimes he believed his ears, sometimes he could not bring himself to believe them, and resorted to the serpentine audiovisual printouts made of all the conversations. Ribbons of white paper many meters long festooned the broad table and trailed on the floor. Every now and then Reuben seized the album, in which specimen sound pictures were classified sometimes by phonemes, sometimes according to the bass tone of particular male voices. With a copying pencil, blunt at both ends, for Reuben, sharpening a pencil was a task requiring lengthy preparation, he marked places on the tapes that particularly interested him. Reuben was carried away. His dark brown eyes were ablaze. He smoked pipe or cigarettes, incessantly, and there was ash everywhere. On his unkempt, matted beard, the sleeves of his greasy overalls, a button was missing from one cuff. The table, the tapes, the armchair, and the album containing the audiovisual specimens. He had forgotten his liver and his painful hypertonia, forgotten that he had eaten nothing since the cake at yesterday's birthday party. He was by now in that state of heightened awareness when vision is sharp enough to single out a grain of sand, and memory readily supplies all that it has stored over the years. He had not once asked what time it was. He had made just one attempt on arrival to open a ventilation pane in order to make up for the fresh air he had missed, but Smolosidov said sullenly, "Don't do that. I've got a cold." After that, he did not leave his seat all day. Did not once go to the window to see the snow turning grey and crumbly under the damp west wind. He did not hear Shikin knocking and Smolosidov refusing to let him in. He saw Reutemann come and go, as if through a fog, and muttered something to him without looking around. He was oblivious of the bell for the lunchtime break and the back-to-work bell. Eating is a sacred ritual for the Czech, but Reuben's instinctive hunger was only aroused when someone, Reutemann once more, shook him by the shoulder and pointed to fried eggs, dumplings in sour cream, and stewed fruit on a side table. Reuben's nostrils twitched, his jaw dropped in surprise, but his thoughts still seemed to be elsewhere. Surveying this food of the gods in bewilderment, as though wondering what it was meant for, he moved to the little table and began swallowing without tasting, in a hurry to get back to his work. Reuben did not appreciate his meal, but it had cost Reutemann more than if he had provided it as his own expense. He had sat on the phone for 2 hours, getting first the Special Technology Department, then General Bulbanyuk, then the Prison Administration, then the Supply Department, and finally Lieutenant Colonel Klementyev to authorize the issue of so much food. Those at the other end of the phone had, in turn, to square bookkeepers and other persons. The difficulty was that Reuben was only entitled to the rations of a Category 3 prisoner, and Reutemann was trying to get him into Category 1, the dietetic variant at that, for a few days, while he worked on a job of special importance to the state. After all the others had agreed, the prison itself raised practical objections. Ingredients requested unavailable in prison stores. Cook paid at appropriate rate for preparing individual menus, likewise unavailable. Reutemann now sat facing Reuben across the table, not looking at him like a taskmaster awaiting the fruits of a slave's labour, but smiling affectionately at this overgrown child, enchanted with him, envying his inspiration, choosing the right moment to discover where that half-day's work was leading and to join in himself. Reuben finished off the food, and his features relaxed as he returned to his senses. For the first time since early morning, he smiled.
"You shouldn't have fed me so well, Adam Veniaminovich. Sater uenter non studet libenter. A traveller always breaks the back of his journey before he stops to eat."
"Just look at the clock, Lev Grigorievich. It's 3:15.
"Eh? I thought it wasn't 12 yet."
"Lev Grigorievich, I'm consumed with curiosity. What have you come up with?" This was not an order from a superior. Reutemann seemed to be pleading with Reuben, afraid that he would refuse. When his better feelings were allowed to show, Reutemann was very likable, in spite of his ungainly appearance and thick lips, which were always parted because of the polyps in his nose.
"It's just a beginning, just preliminary conclusions, Adam Veniaminovich."
"And what are they?"
"Some of them may be disputable, but one is incontrovertible. The science of phonoscopy, born today, has a rational core."
"You aren't letting yourself get carried away, are you, Lev Grigorievich?"
Reutemann was as eager to believe as Reuben, but his own training told him that in an arts man like Reuben, enthusiasm might prevail over scientific rigour.
"When did you ever see me carried away?"
Reuben asked rather huffily, smoothing his untidy beard.
"All the work we've been doing as a team for nearly 2 years now, all these phonetic and stylistic analyses of Russian speech, our study of sound pictures, classification of voices, examination of national, group, and individual intonations, all that Anton Nikolaevich regarded as an idle pastime, and, let's admit it, we ourselves felt doubt creeping in at times, all that is now yielding its cumulative results. Maybe we should get Nyazhin over here. What do you think?"
"If the business expands, by all means. But for the present, we have to show that we deserve to survive by completing our first assignment."
"First assignment? That first assignment is half of an entire science. It can't be done in a hurry."
"But, Lev Grigorievich, you mean... Surely you realize how urgently necessary it all is."
He understood, all right. Lyovko Rubin, member of the League of Communist Youth, had grown up with those words ringing in his ears. They were written large in the slogans of the '30s. There was no steel, no electricity, no bread, no textiles. There were needs, and there was urgency, and blast furnaces were erected, steel mills set rolling. Then, before the war, Rubin the scholar, blissfully engrossed in the study of the leisurely 18th century, had become soft. But the old rallying cry, urgently needed, of course, still awakened a response, and compelled him to follow through to the end any task he undertook.
Urgently needed.
Who could doubt it, when there was a risk that this greatest of traitors might slip through the net? The light from outside was fading. They lit the overhead lamp, sat down at the work table, and examined the sample passages marked on the audiovisual tapes with blue or red pencil. Characteristic sounds, consonant combinations, lines showing intonations. They did this together, just the two of them, ignoring Smolosidov. He had not left the room for a single minute all day long. He sat now over a magnetic tape, guarding it like a sullen black dog, looking at the backs of their heads, and this unwavering hard stare pressed on their skulls and brains. Smolosidov deprived them of something very small, but supremely important, unconstraint. He witnessed their vacillations, and he would witness their confident report to higher authority. They took turns to affirm and deny. Reutemann was inhibited by his mathematical training, but spurred on by hope of promotion. Rubin's disinterested desire to establish new science on solid foundations was sobering, but he risked being carried away by his 5-year plan training and his duty to the party. In the end, they settled for a short list of 5 suspects, agreeing without much discussion that there was no need to tape the voices of the 4 detained at Sokolniki underground station. They had been arrested too late anyway, nor those of the handful of Ministry of State Security personnel offered by Bulbanuk as a last resort. They also ruled out, as psychologically implausible, the supposition that the caller was not the person who knew the facts, but someone acting for him. Even with just five, they had their work cut out. They listened to all five voices live and compared them with that of the culprit. Then they repeated the process, using audiovisual tapes.
"Look what a great help audiovisual analysis is," Rubin declared enthusiastically. "You can tell that the criminal begins by trying to disguise his voice. But how does the change show on the audiovisual tape? All that happens is that the frequencies are lower, but the characteristic vocal tune hasn't changed. That is our main discovery, the vocal tune. Even if the criminal had tried to disguise his voice throughout, he could not have concealed its most distinctive features. But we still don't know enough about the limits within which voices can be changed," Reutemann insisted. "It may be that the range of variability in micro-intonations is very wide. Just listening to them, you might be unsure whether these were two different voices or the same one. But on the audiovisual tapes, differences in volume and frequency seemed to show up more clearly. Unfortunately, their audiovisual recording apparatus was still crude. It distinguished too few frequency bands and tended to indicate volume in unreadable smears. Their excuse must be that it had not been intended for such crucial work. Of the five suspects, Zavazin and Siagaviti could quite confidently be excluded, if indeed the nascent science allowed conclusions to be drawn from a single conversation. Petrov, too, could be tentatively excluded. Rubin, flushed with enthusiasm, rejected him outright. The voices of Volodin and Shevronuk, however, resembled that of the criminal in the frequency of their basic tone, and shared with it certain phonemes, O, R, L, and Sh, and were similar in their specific speech tunes. The similarity of these voices should provide a starting point for the development of their new science, phonoscopy, and the elaboration of its methods. Study of the fine distinctions between them should enable them to devise and perfect the sensitive apparatus of the future. Rubin and Reutemann leaned back in their chairs with the triumphant air of creators. They could foresee an organization similar to that which existed for fingerprints, an all-union voice library, where the voice patterns of all who had ever come under suspicion would be on record. Any criminal conversation could be recorded, referred to the audiovisual archive, and the criminal would instantly be identified as surely as the thief who leaves his fingerprints on the door of a safe. At this point, Askalupov's adjutant looked around the door to warn them that his boss would be along shortly. This brought them to their senses. Science was all very well, but right now they must formulate their conclusions and defend them with a single voice before the head of the department. Reutemann believed, in fact, that what they had achieved was important enough in itself. But knowing that his masters liked certainties, not hypotheses, he gave in to Rubin, agreed to consider Petrov's voice above suspicion, and to report to the Major General that Shevronuk and Volodin were the only suspects remaining. These two must be further examined in the next few days. There was one complicating factor. According to information received, two of the three rejected, Siagaviti and Petrov, didn't know a word of any foreign language, whereas Shevronuk spoke English and Dutch, and Volodin spoke French like a native, fluent English, and a little Italian. It seemed improbable that at the critical moment when mutual incomprehension threatened to terminate the conversation, a man who knew his listener's language would have uttered not so much as an impatient exclamation in it. "In addition to everything else, Lev Grigorievich," Reutemann mused, "we must not overlook the psychological aspect. We must try to imagine what sort of man could bring himself to make such a telephone call. What was his motive? Then compare our imaginary picture of him with the concrete images we have of the suspects. We must ensure that in future we phonoscopists are supplied not only with a suspect's voice and name, but with a brief account of his position, his activities, his lifestyle, perhaps even a curriculum vitae. I think I could construct some sort of psychological sketch of our criminal right now.
But Rubin, who only the night before, arguing with the artist, had said that objective knowledge is uncoloured by emotional preconceptions, had already decided in favour of one of the two suspects.
"I have, of course, already given some thought to the psychological aspects, Adam Veniaminovich, and they seem to tip the balance in favour of Volodin. In his conversation with his wife..."
Volodin's conversation with his wife had influenced Lev more than he realized. Her musical telephone voice had troubled his senses. If anything was to be appended to the tape, Lev would have opted for a photograph of Volodin's wife.
"In his conversation with his wife, Volodin seems notably listless, subdued, apathetic even, and this is very characteristic of a criminal afraid that he is under observation. There's nothing of the sort in Shevronek's cheerful Sunday chatter, I quite agree. But a pretty pair we will look if we start relying from the word go on extraneous considerations rather than the objective data of our science. I've got quite a lot of experience of work with audiovisual records by now, and you must believe me. A number of subtle indications convince me beyond doubt that the criminal is Shevronek. Only shortage of time has prevented me from measuring these clues on the tape and translating them into the language of numbers, something for which this arts man never had time. But if somebody took me by the throat here and now and told me to mention just one name and swear that he's the criminal, I would almost without hesitation name Shevronek.
But that's not what we're going to do, Lev Grigorievich. Let's get to work with the gauge and do our translation into the language of numbers. Then we can talk.
Think how long it will take. It's supposed to be urgent.
But if the truth demands it...
Look for yourself, then. Just look for yourself.
Rubin fingered the tapes again, showering ash on them, heatedly insisting on Shevronek's guilt. Askalupov found them engaged in this when he stomped in authoritatively on his short legs. They all knew him well, and the hat pulled down over his brow and the curl of his upper lip told them that he was acutely dissatisfied. They jumped up, and he sat in a corner of the sofa, thrust his hands into his pockets, and growled at them.
Well?
It was an order. Rubin behaved correctly and left it to Reutemann. As Reutemann made his report, Askalupov's flabby face was expressive of deep thought. His eyelids were sleepily lowered, and he didn't even rise to look at the specimens of tape presented to him. Rubin listened to Reutemann, and his heart sank. Even in the carefully chosen words of this clever man, the essence, the inspiration of his research had been missed. Reutemann summed up by saying that Shevronek and Volodin were the suspects, but further recorded conversations were needed to make a final judgment possible. After which he looked at Rubin and said, "But perhaps Lev Grigorievich wants to add something or make a correction?" Rubin regarded Askalupov as a blockhead, pure and simple. But then and there he was also the eye of the state, the representative of Soviet power, and the unwitting representative of all those forces of progress to which Rubin had surrendered himself. So Rubin spoke passionately, flourishing tapes and albums of audiovisual recordings. He begged the general to understand that although their present conclusion left two possibilities, there was nothing uncertain about the science of phonoscopy itself. It was just that the time allowed was too short for a definitive conclusion, and more recordings were needed. But his personal tentative conclusion was that the boss, no longer half asleep, listened for a while with a contemptuous frown, before interrupting Rubin's explanation.
"I don't need all this ifing and butting. I don't give a damn for your so-called science. I want to catch the criminal. Give it to me straight. You've got the criminal here on this table, right? He isn't walking around scot-free. Somebody else? Not one of these five?"
He glowered at them while they stood before him with nothing to support them. The paper tapes Rubin was holding trailed on the floor. Behind their backs, Smolosidov crouched over the tape recorder like a black dragon. Rubin felt deflated. He had expected the conversation to go quite differently. Reutemann, who was more accustomed to the manners of the boss class, plucked up courage and said, Yes, Foma Gurjanovich, I really am, we really are. We are sure that it's between these five.
What else could he say?
Askalupov screwed up his eyes more tightly.
You take full responsibility for what you're saying.
Yes, we take responsibility.
Askalupov struggled up from the sofa.
I didn't force you to say it, mind. I'm going straight to the minister to make my report. We'll arrest both the sons of bitches.
From the way he said it and the hostile look he gave them, Rubin and Reutmann might as well be the two to be arrested. Rubin protested.
Wait a bit longer. Just another 24 hours. Give us a chance to prove it conclusively. Well, when the interrogation begins, we'll put a microphone on the interrogator's desk, and you can record them for 3 hours at a time, if you like. But one of them has to be innocent, Rubin exclaimed. What's that mean, innocent?
Askalupov's green eyes opened wide in surprise.
Not guilty of anything at all?
Security will know how to deal with it. They'll find something.
He left with never a kind word for the adepts of the new science. That was Askalupov's managerial style. Never praise your subordinates if you want them to work harder. It was not a style he himself had invented. It had been handed down from on high by the man himself. They sat down on the very chairs on which, not so long ago, they had dreamed of a great future for their embryonic science, and were silent. It was as though what they had constructed with such precision and delicacy of touch had been trampled underfoot, as though phonoscopy were not wanted at all. If two could be arrested instead of one, why not all five to make absolutely sure?
Reutmann felt keenly how precarious the new group was, remembered that half of the acoustics lab had been disbanded, remembered yet again his uneasy feeling in the small hours that the world was a bleak place and he was alone in it. As for Rubin, the enthusiasm that had kept him working hour after hour, lost to the world, had burned itself out. He remembered his aching liver, his aching head, remembered that his hair was falling out, that his wife was getting older, that he still had 5 years to serve, that with every year the apparatchiks, damn them, were driving the revolution deeper and deeper into the morass, and now they'd made a pariah of Yugoslavia. Both Reutmann and Rubin kept their thoughts to themselves and sat there in silence. Smolosidov, with his eyes on the backs of their heads, was also silent. Rubin had been quick to pin up a map of China on the wall, with the territory held by the communists, coloured with a red pencil. This map, at least, was heartwarming. In spite of everything, we are winning. A knock at the door summoned Reutmann. The joint party and Komsomol political education session was just beginning. He had to round up his subordinates and put in an appearance himself.